Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Harvey Feinberg. I'm the chair of the review committee to review the IHR and the H1N1 pandemic experience here at the World Health Organization. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to meet with you at the conclusion of the first meeting of the committee. I expect some of you, perhaps all of you, were able to sit in on portions, if not all, of the deliberations over the last 3 days. So I will not try to recount the experience on the assumption that you have witnessed it yourselves. If that's not a good assumption, since I could barely see over the railing to identify who's there, then please let me know. Is that a bad assumption?
Okay.
Well, maybe I'll, if the others, with your forbearance, then let me just take a minute to describe what the committee's role is and what we're trying to accomplish. The committee is made up of 29 individuals who were chosen to represent a spectrum of expertise, a variety of backgrounds and experience, a range of countries and regions of the WHO represented, balanced in gender and racial composition, all brought together for a purpose of improving the World Health Organization's, indeed the world's, ability to contend with pandemics like the H1N1 in the future, and to improve the functioning of the international health regulations. The international health regulations of 2005 called for a review in 5 years' time of how well they were working. So the committee was convened in part to fulfill that requirement of the international health regulations. Since over the last year and a half, the experience of the H1N1 has been so important and indeed represents a kind of powerful test of the workings of the IHR, the Director General, with the approval of the Executive Board of the World Health Assembly, elected to combine a committee's function to review both the IHR in general and the performance of the World Health Organization in H1N1. This 3-day meeting was a first effort of the committee to organize its work, to begin to identify the critical issues that would need to be looked into. The meeting had some unusual features for an expert review committee, which legally we are. One of the striking features, which indeed is called for in the IHR regulations, is that member states, representatives, and representatives of intergovernment organizations and non-government organizations are invited to be present at the deliberations of the review committee. And so these last 3 days, we benefited and interacted from the members of the state parties who were present, who offered their views, who reacted to the deliberations, and provided a very important sounding board and set of witnesses for the work of the committee. In the end, it will be the committee's task to present a report to the Director General, and the Director General, in turn, will provide her response to the report, and the two ultimately will be presented to the World Health Assembly as called for in the IHR regulations. Our plan is to present an interim report, essentially outlining the approach we intend to take at the May 2010 World Health Assembly. And if the committee is able to complete its task in a timely way, the report should then, in a final form, the ultimate report, be presented to the World Health Assembly of 2011. The Director General, in her charge to the committee, made clear that the committee will have free access to to individuals working at the WHO, ready access to all documentation that the committee may wish to examine in relation to H1N1 or the international health regulations. We'll have a complete freedom of inquiry in terms of the areas it wishes to examine, the people it wishes to interview or to hear from, and the topics it chooses ultimately to draw conclusions upon and make recommendations about. The committee is brought together as a group of individuals, not representing any organization, not representing any state, but representing each individual's own best judgment to apply to the questions that we've been asked. I'm here because I was elected by the committee to be its chair, and I look forward in that role to working with you in the press and others in the media who will be interested and wish to follow the work of the committee and to be informed from time to time on any questions that you have in mind about what we're doing and how we're going about it. So with that background, let me pause and invite any questions that you may have, and I look forward to talking with you. Yes. If you wouldn't mind, it would help me, although I've met a few of you, I haven't met all of you, and it would be a help to me if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourselves, although I presume most of you know all the rest of you here, but I'm the one who doesn't, so if you'll bear with me and introduce yourselves, I would be grateful. Mr. Jordan, we have met, but...
Frank Jordan, AP.
Yes.
You stressed the fact that the committee members here as individuals, and indeed Dr. Chan spoke of the need for an independent and critical review. But I was wondering if several of the members are advisors to WHO, and most of them are government employees in some capacity. What scope will these people have in practice to write something that is critical and independent when they have such a close relationship with the people that they're scrutinizing? And a quick specific question, how many of the panel members were involved in any way in drawing up the what is known as the pandemic phase alerts scale?
I can respond quickly to the specific and then come back to the very important general question. I don't know the answer to the specific question. I don't know if any was or how many may have been. But it illustrates really in a specific way the more general point that you're raising about the backgrounds and potential sources of, let us call it, extraneous influence on the independent and objective judgment of any individual involved in an exercise such as this. Whenever you're putting together an expert group like this, you're always trying to combine people who are unconflicted with people who are knowledgeable. That is, you want each individual to be free of conflict and also to be very knowledgeable about the subject on which they're advising. In this regard, I think it's useful to distinguish a conflict which emanates from a financial interest, which is, in the terms I would use, a conflict of interest, in which, by that I mean that the individual might hold an interest in a company that might benefit or suffer, depending on what is decided, or have some other financial stake in the outcome. As a general rule, it's, I think, good practice, and I believe it is the WHO practice, as far as I understand it, to try to eliminate those type of financial conflicts in the composition of expert committees. When it comes to the positions of individuals, the roles they have, the appointments they may have had in the past, the views that they've previously expressed, the research they may have done, the involvements they may have had, all of these can be relevant and may be sources of what I would describe in my terms of bias, by which I mean not an erroneous view distorted. I mean simply a preceding predisposition based on your experience and knowledge to think a particular way about the question. So when you compare that to the ideal of an open-minded, unconflicted, unbiased involvement, you have to face the reality that to get the expertise that you want, you have also the possibility, indeed, I would say the usual occurrence of people with preformed views or roles that were related. So the practical question now to come to your first point, what do you do about that? And I think the answer is twofold. Number one, you want to expose and make open the biases so that everyone on the committee, as well as others, know about the backgrounds, the roles, the previously expressed views, the relevant positions that may have been taken by members. And secondly, where it may come to the committee's making determinations on matters that specifically relate to the role of a member, knowing and having exposed these biases, you can take the step of recusing that member or members from the part of the deliberations that relate to their functions. And for us as a committee, we're actually still in the process of identifying all the possible sources of bias. This is a committee that is composed of individuals who've done a lot of things related to public health and including influenza and have, as you point out, positions in government or had positions in government. And so we're still in the process of gathering this information about the members, and our intent is to be able to review that with the committee so that everyone on the committee is informed about those backgrounds and that we're all more sensitized as individuals to the connection between our previous positions or views and the work that the committee will undertake. So that's the two-part approach, exposure and specific instance recusal. Yes?
Lisa Schlein, Voice of America. I'd like to get a sense of how the discussions went over the three-day period, whether you spoke about H1N1 in rather general terms or whether you were rather more specific in terms of the areas that you should really deal with first. In other words, did you also give people homework, you know, when they go home and do this? And one more thing, whether there was any kind of a separation made between the way H1N1 is occurring in developed and in developing countries, because maybe the virus is the same, but the effect is different.
Let me give you a little more flesh on the bones of the work of the last 3 days, just to help on the first question. The committee as a whole took advantage of the presence of the member states to invite them early to offer their perspective on the questions that we were being asked to consider. And these presentations, which were verbally just a few minutes apiece, but can be supplemented by documents and other materials that they will send, help to highlight a number of issues that the member states consider important. For example, it was very important to recognize the challenge of containment as a strategy early in the epidemic. That was one of the points they raised. They raised the questions about the characterization of the pandemic phases and specifically how the question of severity relates to the definition of phases. They talked about the challenge of equity, which relates to your third question, and the expression of this epidemic in developing as well as in more developed countries. So that helps set the stage and identify a number of critical problems that the committee will need to deliberate on over time. The committee then organized its work in the bulk of the days according to five areas, three of which dealt specifically with, if you will, aspects or phasing of the pandemic. The first being the preparedness phase, the pre-pandemic issues. The second being what we called in shorthand the alert phase, that is, everything that leads up through the epidemiology analysis and decision-making to recognition of what is happening. And the third, the response phase. How do you respond to the epidemic in its various stages? A fourth group really dealt with a cross-cutting issue which is central indeed to our conversation, which is communication. And communication we understood and took to be very broad, not simply between the experts and the public or an organization and the public, but communication at all levels, the communication from world headquarters to regional headquarters to states, the communication to professionals and to others involved, communication and working relations with the media at all levels. So these occupied a specific portion of our time. And finally, we did want to attend particularly to the IHR as an important part of our work, the International Health Regulations. You're all familiar with that shorthand, I trust. But the International Health Regulations as a topic in itself, particularly as it relates to non-pandemic questions. So these five, if you will, subgroups occupied a significant portion of our effort. In addition, we had the opportunity to hear some very useful initial presentations from critical areas that we know will be of concern. Beyond the original overview that was provided by officials at WHO and the legal structures of what we're doing and the overall experience with the pandemic, we had specific presentations on the role and workings of the Emergency Committee, which is the committee charged with the decision-making or recommendations to the DG about the scale and characterization of the epidemic. And we heard very useful presentations on the vaccine program of WHO and particular reference to the H1N1 pandemic and the program of advice on the vaccine area with the committee that's got the acronym of SAGE, S-A-G-E. It's a wonderful acronym, I think. Maybe the best. So we took all of that on board. We reflected on how we will proceed in the bulk of our work, and this is where your homework question comes in. It's not just that the staff here have to get home to do the homework. It's that we're probably never going to let them get home with the amount that we're asking them to do in helping us to prepare and move forward in the next phase of our work. But in answer to your question, that's how we organized and delved into the questions in these initial 3 days. But, yes, sir.
Hi, I was Rikano from Kyoto News of Japan. I actually have two questions, both related. A lot of the discussions you had in the last 3 days seem to have centered on not so much the IHR, but the pandemic preparedness plan. So I'd like to know, will your committee be reviewing the pandemic preparedness plan? And the second is, should this happen, part of the discussions were on the questions of including severity, under sort of mortality and morbidity in the definitions of a pandemic. Now, in the 1999 and 2005 pandemic preparedness plan, I actually haven't been able to see them, severity, mortality and morbidity is clearly part of the definition of a pandemic. This was removed in the 2007-2009 plan. So should we understand that the removal of severity was a mistake?
You shouldn't understand that from me. We have drawn no conclusions yet. The committee's job will be to look at this as well as other aspects of H1N1 management. But I would stress that what we've done in these first 3 days is to, in effect, tee up the problems, identify them, characterize them, develop a plan of work, but we've not tried even to draw any conclusions, much less even specific findings. So, for example, the history of the definitions and the way the pandemic preparedness plans have evolved is very interesting and important input to the thinking and understanding of our committee. But we've not gotten that far as a committee as yet. What is evident just from the discussion we've had in these few days is that the committee will have to come to grips with this specific question of the place of severity in pandemic characterization. That's not to prejudge what the conclusion may be, but it will certainly be on the work agenda of this committee. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
I'm Gabriela Sotomayor from Mexican News Agency. to learn for the future, do you think that, because there is a big actor that is not here, that is the pharmaceutical industry. So do you think that it should be revised to their response to the pandemic? I mean,
the response of the pharmaceutical industry? Well, it's not the purview of our committee to judge that specifically, but we're looking at the whole of the pandemic. So the behavior and the expected contributions of all the relevant actors have to enter somehow into our reflections, because even if you're just trying to work, as we have been charged, to help the WHO, for the WHO to do its work, it has to be able to take account of all of the relevant actors. So in some sense, they will come to be part of our deliberation. But it is, if you said the question, is this in your charge, not explicitly. It's simply what we'll have to do in order to complete the work for the WHO. Yes.
The issue of severity and the alert phases, I mean, as someone who covered the outbreak, was probably one of the most confusing parts. At the time, though, it was raised repeatedly in April and May of last year that these were the confusing parts. And at the time, no one really listened to what the questions the journalists repeatedly asked that they were getting from the public. Now it's a year later. You'll learn lessons for next time, but is anyone looking into why nothing was done then, when it was obvious that the public was confused about these very things already at the beginning?
I don't know the answer to that specific question of what the thinking was at that time as of now. Maybe we will learn more about this. And in fact, for those of you who were not at the meeting, one of the requests that I made to our journalist colleagues, if I may use that word, is to invite your help to us in understanding what the critical issues have been, also from your point of view. I asked expressly if you could, the way I put it is, when you're thinking of critics of the WHO, who do you call? Because we want to hear from the informed critics. And also, we need to understand better what created problems for the media, as well to do your job. What was it that was difficult and maybe could be better understood so that the experts and the WHO in the future can be more effective and enable the journalism community to do even better its job? So it's a genuine question that I would reinforce in this. Now, to come to the point, this back and forth about severity historically, and then how did people deal with it acutely, it at least suggests that it's a difficult problem, because if it were a simple problem, it would have been accommodated in an easy way long before. So what can you imagine are some of the difficulties? Just to give a suggestion of some of the things that were not discussed in detail in our committee, so I'm responding now in a way just more generally, but for the sake of the question. When you think about severity, you have at least three problems. The first is defining what you mean by severity. So are you talking about mortality? Are you talking about morbidity or illness? Are you talking about some combination of the numbers and the severity in meaning severity? What do you really mean by it? So that's the first challenge. Second challenge is, how do you measure it? Not simply in theory, but how do you measure it practically and in real time, in a way that can be used to inform your decisions? And third, how do you account for the variety of severity in different settings at the same time? So you may have a country experiencing a degree of severity very different to another, or within a country, you may have subpopulations experiencing degrees of severity very different to the other. So all of these initial questions need to be very well appreciated and thought through in order to begin to answer this question, how could you combine severity and extent? It's very interesting. If I could offer a metaphor, when you're dealing with a hurricane, think of it. You know, we grade the hurricanes, grade 1, 2, 3, etc. Well, that's all about severity. The only measure that determines the hurricane grade is the top speed measured in the hurricane. It's not a measure of how big the hurricane is. The hurricane could be 200 kilometers or it could be 600 kilometers. It doesn't count that. It's kind of the inverse. It's only about severity. It's not about the size. Interestingly, it's very precisely measurable. You can put in the middle of the hurricane the measuring device, and you can tell to the kilometer per hour exactly how much speed is there. You can do it. You can track it visually. So in the case of characterization, you have inverted what you think is important compared to the flu now. You have very precise measurement. And by the way, we're all familiar with kilometers per hour. We know what that means. So it's got very good meaning to everyone. So I use that as just a kind of foil to illustrate the difference to certain classification schemes and the challenge in the case of a pandemic of applying similar thinking to try to make it meaningful and usable for the public. So this is all going to be part of the deliberation of our committee. Please, sure.
I mean, just to sort of again go back to the issue of how it was handled, to clarify, is the committee reviewing the regulations, or is it also reviewing how WHO staff then dealt with the regulations?
Both.
Is this going to go to the level of personal responsibility?
It's going to deal with both the regulations and are they effective and are they usable? And it's going to deal with the specific actions taken by WHO or not taken, as the case may be, in reference to management of the pandemic. The spirit behind this, though, I want to add, is not to point a finger at wrongdoers or fault-finding. That's not our goal. Our goal is to identify lessons that can help the future. And that is the way we are trying to carry out our work. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Peter Cavella from the French news agency, AFP. There are a few comments from committee members and others during the last 3 days relating to the nature of the virus and where it comes from. On the one hand, you might have something like Professor McKenzie, who this afternoon mentioned that H1N1 was a strange virus, as you put it. On the other hand, you might contrast that with rather sort of affirmative statement from the World Animal Health Organization, the OIE, which the representative said, that I think it was basically that they came to the firm conclusion that this is not an animal ownership. Does the public health community know enough about the, or let's put it this way, are you able to look far enough upstream into the life of this virus? And is that an issue which will be of concern to the committee?
The committee is not primarily concerned with the origin of the virus, but the background of origin of influenza as a human disease and the epidemiology of the virus are relevant to the considerations that we are going to try to take. It's important for us to try to be very clear in our thinking and understanding about the characterizations of the virus and the disease. For example, when we talk about the non-animal origin of the illness, it doesn't mean that the virus did not originate in human-animal interaction. Almost surely it did. What is meant is that the contemporary infection of humans is caused by other humans. It's not caused by exposure now to animals. These are two very different things, both true. So that the intent of the statement that it's not an animal-transmitted disease isn't to characterize the origin historically. It's rather to differentiate the worry which can be falsely assigned to interface with animals, or particularly with food products derived from animals, and worry that that may transmit the virus. From a scientific point of view, a pork chop is not a source of swine flu. So this is the intent on the statement about animals and viruses. So even though it's not the primary responsibility or the main focus, it's in the background. It's part of the, if you will, the gestalt of influenza that the committee has to absorb in its deliberation in order to make what we ultimately come up with meaningful and relevant to influenza in the future.
Sure. Can I take an example? For example, one health expert, a renowned health expert, told me before this meeting that there are now tests that tend to indicate that there were human cases, or might have been a human case, or cases, not clear, in January. So far, I believe most of the talk has been about March.
Yes.
And then it's gradually moved back as people do research.
Yes.
But if you put it another way, if you look at how fast the pandemic, at least, how fast the swine flu or H1N1 progressed in 3 months from April, what was happening for the previous 3 months if it didn't there, and shouldn't have been detected earlier?
Yes.
And that would have helped the world respond subsequently as well. That would make a huge difference.
There's a big difference, just to, again, as a general matter. This is commenting on the question, not based on anything we've discussed, because, as you know, we didn't discuss that yet. But just as a general response, there's a big difference between detecting an unknown virus for the first time in practice to going back then knowing what you're looking for and seeing did it ever occur previously, were there any evidence that occurred previously. Take the HIV pandemic as a counterexample. The HIV pandemic burst on the public scene in the 1980s. That's when people became aware of HIV, with the first cases mysterious. Originally, in the U.S., it was called gay-related immunodeficiency syndrome. That was the first name of it. The virus itself was later identified. And after that, historically, cases could be detected by means of serologic sampling and other mechanisms even decades earlier. So these are two very different propositions. Detecting historically an earlier occurrence when you know what you're looking for, and being able to detect for the first time a new outbreak or a new condition. Now, it would be astonishing. It would be, in fact, inconceivable that the very first human case would be detected. I mean, that would be like saying that you actually felt the first raindrop that fell on Geneva. You know, that's hard. You have to be in exactly the right spot, and it has to fall right on your nose, and then you know it's raining. But if it starts to pour, you can be pretty sure you're getting wet. So in a similar way, what you need in a surveillance system is not this ideal that you can detect the very, very first case, but you need earlier and earlier capacity not to overlook the clinically evident cases that can reveal a new outbreak and give you the maximum time for preparation. And the two are not at all incompatible, going as early as you can and recognizing you can't get the first. Yes, we'll work our way back around.
Okay. I was wondering...
I'm sorry, there was a follow-up? Please.
I was wondering, sir, do you have experts in your 29 members with background in pharmaceutical production, marketing, and logistics? And also, if you intend to look in your deliberations at the change of the terminology, not to use the word swine flu, which occurred overnight, and two other agencies were involved in the decision with the WHO out of the blue.
On the first question, I would say that, to my knowledge, there's no member of the committee with deep expertise in the manufacturing and production of vaccine. I state that with a qualification to my knowledge, because I don't want to misrepresent the backgrounds. Having said that, it's also the case that there are many, many types of expertise that the committee will need to seek out to inform itself, but that cannot be represented in the membership of the 29 individuals who are present. So it's an example, but it's just one. There could be quite a large number of those. On the naming conventions, this came up actually in the presentations in the first phase of our meeting, and it is clearly something about the management of the alert phase that we will need to consider. Is anyone else not asked a question who wishes to at the moment? Yeah, let me do that first. Yes, please. Yes. I didn't say expressly that, but thank you. I will. The committee intends to meet again sometime during the last week of June. That's the week starting June 28 and extending to July 2nd. We don't know yet which 3 days will be best, but we expect to have a three-day meeting during those 5 days. So that's our next formal step. In terms of the work plan, we're intending to continue to have a kind of conversation on the topics by the members of the committee. We have a lot of work for the Secretariat to do in preparation for our deliberations at the next meeting. And beyond that meeting, we've agreed that we will schedule at least a third meeting tentatively set for the week of September 27, and that again, which 3 days of that week ending on October 1st. We haven't chosen, but it will be during that week. So that's our current plan.
And when would you expect to produce the final report?
Well, if we're able, we would strive to have our final report out in time for the Director General to present it formally to the World Health Assembly of May 2011. Yeah, question?
Hi, yes. I was just wondering if you could talk about whether the committee will address or has already begun to address WHO's role in facilitating technology transfer and capacity building to improve access to vaccines in countries without the manufacturing capacity. Including IP flexibilities if they're necessary.
Yes. Could everyone hear the question? Yes. The presentation that we had today on vaccine program at WHO touched upon these questions. And the committee, in its posing of questions afterward, did include desire for more information on the issues of capacity and on the pre-qualification questions. So we expect we will be investigating those along with our other topics in the coming months. So, now.
Now. Out of curiosity, I'm wondering how you approach what appears to be this very broad topic and what may have landed you into this committee exercise to begin with, as to whether the pandemic has been hyped around the world. I've been reading reports which are beginning to scapegoat the media for having hyped it. I read something else about medical workers, health workers, refusing to be vaccinated, and they should know better, maybe. So have you been dealing with this, and broadly speaking, how do you approach this, or is this something that magically comes together after you've done put together all the other elements of your investigation?
Yeah. Well, on this question of scapegoating the media after all turnabout is fair play. So you have to expect you're going to be the subject of accusation in the same way. What is the phrase? It's feeding the hand that bites you is the opposite. So yes, you just have to expect it. It's part of the territory that comes with being responsible journalists, and even more so if you're an irresponsible journalist. But that's just the way the world is. Now, we are very mindful that a number of criticisms have been leveled at the WHO and more generally about the management of this pandemic. And we want to give a hearing to those. We want to take account of those. We want to consider those. And indeed, today I also asked our journalist colleagues if you would be willing to share with me the answer to the question, when you're looking for a critic, who do you call? Which was really a way of asking, who do you feel is informed and critical about the process? Because we'd like to hear from them. We would like to understand what their criticisms are and the basis for them. We want to be able to take that into account. We want to face up to those. We're not here to either defend or to prosecute the WHO. That's not our job. We're here to find out as best we can, in as truthful a way as we can, what are the lessons that we can learn. Okay. And finally, we'll take one more question.
Since we're in the early stages of this whole process, I will come back to the question of the composition and the purpose of the committee, seeing as they're really on that many questions we can ask at this stage about the content of your deliberations. You've only just started.
Yes.
I still find it difficult to understand how this committee can be described as an external committee, given the relationships between the members and WHO and governments. I mean, no US Senate hearing or British Parliamentary Committee hearing would operate in this way. They would have people like the members in as witnesses, but there would have to be a line drawn between those with an interest, because they worked on the whole process that is being scrutinized and the people who are doing the scrutiny.
Yeah. I'll offer my take on it, but again, I'm one of the appointees, I'm not the appointer, so I can only give you my view about it. I believe that when the term external is used in describing this committee or this type of committee, essentially what it means is non-employees. It means people who are not employed or in the payment of the WHO. Now, it doesn't mean utterly disconnected. It didn't rule out anyone who's consulted for or helped advise either other governments or WHO. And so that was the distinction that I think would apply to, just to the definition of that word. If you said, well, how can it be truly independent in judgment because it has had these previous connections, if that was the thrust, then I'd return to my discussion of bias. I mean, we have to recognize that every one of us brings predispositions based on our experience, our knowledge base, positions we hold or have held, and we're trying to deal with those by exposing and by recusing in specific instances. Whether that's an adequate response to the demands of independence of thought is perhaps a judgment. I would acknowledge it's not a absolutely clear-cut case. I think the reality is, if you're trying to get that combination of expertise and freedom from conflict in a financial sense, you deal with that by acknowledging, exposing, and appropriately recusing at in specific circumstances the members. At least that's the implicit strategy behind this selection. I think I'd leave it at that. That's as much as I can say. So you want to ask one more question? All right. Well, I'm happy to have it. Why not?
I will give an example to ask the question. Mexico was the most concerned country. And there was a ceremony here that the Minister of Health came and donate the eggs or this drink to the world to do the vaccine. Do you remember that very well? No? Yeah, well, there was this ceremony. So after that, Mexico asked to the pharmaceuticals, to the laboratories, to have the vaccine. And the industry said, oh, no, I can't give you because there are countries pre-ordered the vaccines and we can't give it to you. So a lot of countries are throwing away vaccines. A lot of countries doesn't have it. This should not be happening in the future because it's in another emergency. So I don't know if you're going to...
You could have been speaking on behalf of some of the presentations from the member states in your comments, because these questions of equity, fairness, these were raised. And I don't know how we are going to ultimately come forward with fresh ideas on how to improve on this, but I can assure you that the committee will do its best to look at the question. Well, with that, perhaps I would thank you all for your interest and willingness to be here today, and I look forward from time to time to be able to respond to your questions as we go forward. So thank you all.
Let's tell you how to do that, too. We've been taking care of Dr. Feinberg's media while he's here because his communications officer was not able to come out here. But in a few hours, he's getting on a plane, so we want to give you his contact information for his office, which is where all these requests will go through after he leaves Geneva.
I was actually sure you were going to remember that because it means it goes to my office.
That's right.
Okay.
His communications contact is Christine, Christine, Stencil, Stencel, and she wants you to have her direct line, which is +1 202 334 1632. That's +1 202 334 1632. She also wants you to have their main news office number, which is +1 202 334 2138. That's +1 202 334 2138. And her email address is cstencel@nas.edu. For National Academies of Sciences, .edu. Okay? EDU.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Christy, here, thank you very much. And thank you all.
I called that we knew number 2 many times.